There is this thing. Do you realize
what is there is this thing?
Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
Do
you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
You're listening to The Prison Radio Show. My name is Virginia.
And my name is Noah.
And we're your hosts for today's show.
Today we're going to air an interview with Franca as part of what will hopefully become a series of interviews featuring kids talking about prisons. Franca's 10 years old and lives in Montreal. We talked with Franca about prisons, racism, colonialism, and imagining a world without prison. Today we're also going to broadcast an interview with Andrea Ritchie, an organizer in the U.S. and one of the authors of the book Queer Injustice. The interview is from September 2014 and was done by Grit TV. You can find the entirety of the interview on YouTube.
First up, we just wanted to highlight an event that's happening tonight. The Month Against Prison starts tonight with a kickoff cabaret at L'Alizée at 900 Ontario Street. The cabaret will begin at 19:30 with a thorough presentation of the month. After the presentation, there will be an open mic where participants can share their thoughts and visions of the prison system. The cabaret will end with a concert of music by David Rovix, an anarchist and member of the IWW. Demonstrations happened outside of prisons around the world on New Year's Eve. People in Mexico City, Europe, cities across the United States, and in Hamilton, Ontario, stood outside of prisons in their cities and towns and lit fireworks and chanted greetings to people inside. The Prison Radio Show was trying to get someone from Hamilton, Ontario to be on the phone with us, but instead, we bring you a report back from their New Year's Eve noise demo from anarchistnews.org. It reads as follows. For the sixth year in a row, anarchists in southern Ontario held noise demos outside of prisons in the area to show our hatred of prisons and the world that creates them, to show solidarity with folks locked up, and to build our collective strength with a tradition of fun, rowdy demos. This year, we visited the SIL Apps Youth Detention Center in Oakville and made the usual stop at the Barton Jail in Hamilton. The SIL-APS Detention Center, like all youth jails in Ontario, is run by a private corporation that specializes in managing and controlling the lives of young people. This jail is run by KINARC, which also runs school programs and summer camps. This jail, like the psychiatric prison recently built on the Hamilton Mountain, is on the cutting edge of the blending of mental health hospitals and prisons, criminalizing and incarcerating people on the basis of who they are rather than what they have done. The youth in this jail responded enthusiastically to the fireworks, the drum band, and the solidarity, dancing, banging on their windows, and flicking their lights. The Barton Jail is a notorious monument to human misery and cruelty in Hamilton's Beasley neighborhood. Its filthy, overcrowded conditions contribute to frequent deaths, which the guards seize on opportunistically for their own political ends, the expansion of the prison system. The guards in this jail represent a vanguard within the Prison Guards Union, supporting the disgusting and deadly conditions of imprisonment while leading the charge for a more advanced system of incarceration. Four people have died in the jail in the past year, and hundreds more suffer disastrous health consequences or violence as a result of their imprisonment. The prisoners at Barton have come to expect the noise demo and always respond with lots of yelling and banging from inside. Unfortunately, this year the police also seemed to have expected it more than in the past. A couple of cops arrived quickly and began attacking the people they believed were setting off fireworks, and the skirmish quickly escalated with the arrival of more cops, including, oddly, Hamilton's chief of police. Two people were beaten and arrested, but in a strange New Year's gift from the cops, they were released without charge. Many others were de-arrested by the more than 50 people at the demo who attacked the jail with paint and continued setting off fireworks. We were glad to put on a good show of collective rage and resistance for folks on the inside, who pounded louder as the confrontation heated up. The New Year's prison demos are an important tradition in this area. The experience of collective resistance makes the partying that comes after into a celebration of strength and solidarity in the face of systems of control and domination. That was a report back from the New Year's Eve noise demo that happened in Hamilton, Ontario. Later on in the show, we'll be sharing with listeners a report back about the New Year's Eve noise demo that happened in Montreal. But first, here are some ads.
Howl, a night of music and soundscapes at La Paz. Wednesday, the 14th of January. Tamara Filievich presenting the sound art piece Chernobyl Box. Felix Antoine Morin. A solo soundscape based on the crossing of landscapes both rural and urban, and a duo performance between Tehran-born musician Syed Kamchou on kamashe and Stefan Christoph on piano. That's Wednesday, the 14th of January, at 8 o'clock, La Paz, 1214 de la Montagne. Suggested donation $8. Info, howlarts.net. This is a CKUT Radio co-presentation.
This next piece is a conversation with Franca. She is 10. She lives in Montreal. She sat down with us and talked about prison, racism, colonialism, and imagining a world without prisons. We asked her questions, she asked us questions, and we hope that this will be the first in a series of talks with kids on the topic of prisons. If you know someone who might be interested in talking with us, send us an email at prison@ckut.ca. So, what's your name?
Franca.
How old are you?
10, and I'm going to be 11 in January.
And when do you remember when you first heard about prisons?
Well, when I started understanding it, I was about 5, 6, something like that.
Mm-hmm. And it was your parents talking to you about it?
Yes. Well, usually, yeah. Or some of my parents' friends or whatever.
Do you remember what they would tell you when you first learned about it?
Well, they would tell me that, well, we have friends there, and they'd tell me, like, well, I would know someone that's called named Herman, Bell, and David, David something, I don't remember, and they would say that that usually it was for silly reasons or some, that they'd go in prison. And that prison wasn't good or some things like that. And it's even for the people that did something that was really bad, that was really bad, not for a silly reason, was still not good to go in prison. And yeah.
And have you ever been to visit Herman or David?
Yes, I have. And other people, but I don't remember their names.
How? What was it like?
Well, when I went sometimes when I was baby, and now, well, now I remember when we get in, they you have to give your, like, where you're from and whatever, your passport or mm-hmm. something like that, and then they do, like, they put a perp, like, a thing on you, and then you go in this, anyways, in a thing, and then mm-hmm. you get out from it, and then you go, and then you wait on the table for a while, and then you come, and then sometimes there's little places to play or something, you know. And I remember one time when, and then there's, like, also food. There's, like, food, things where you can get food, but they're not that healthy things. More junk food going. Sometimes there's, like, sandwiches or things like that, but they're not the healthiest. And then one time I remember that one time we were sitting, and then there was, like, a bar. Like, like we could still touch, like, do like that, like, touch each other or whatever, but there was a bar that separated our faces a little, something like that. And one time, also, well, there was someone, we had to talk in a microphone together, we could see each other.
But there was, like, a piece of glass in
there? Yeah, and also one time, I was at the place where there was the bar, and there was people lined up, I think, to go to the bathroom, and then the door is still open, and I thought that looked annoying for the people, because they don't have good privacy, and and sometimes they don't get treated well, or they don't get, like, well treated, and they don't get enough food or anything like that. Well, they get food, but not, like, the good things that they need.
What do you think prison is for?
Well, for people that think prison is good, I think they want it to be, like, for to learn them not to do that anymore and to make them stop doing it and to make stop doing it and to learn them that it's not fun if you do something like that or something, and that it's not right to do what they did. And
what do your friends think about prisons? Do you ever talk to your friends about going to visit people?
No, actually, I don't really ever talk to them about it, but sometimes, let's say, there's one of my friends that was going to dress up in an Indian person or something like that, and then I thought it was racist, but then other people didn't know many things, so it's complicated for me to explain things like that. Also, when we're just kids, so I don't have the exact words or anything, and sometimes the adults think what they think, or I don't know, whatever. Yeah, because there's adults that think that prison's good, there's some that mm-hmm. don't, there's some that hate it, there's some that, yeah.
You were talking a little bit about this already, but what do you know about what happens to people who go to prison?
Well, when they go, they're like in a cell, and then sometimes there's bunk beds, sometimes there's bed all by yourself, and there's sometimes a little toilet that I don't think, maybe it's hidden, but maybe it isn't, and then there's like a little sink, and then there's the beds, and then there's a desk with a chair, and maybe a mirror. And they don't have that many stuff in them, just like a few clothes and yeah. And I just have a question for you. Are they allowed to walk around? Like, are their cells locked or they're not?
It depends on the place. So okay. In Canada, at least, there are minimum security prisons, medium security prisons, and maximum.
Okay.
And in maximum security prisons, I think you're not allowed to walk around unless it's lunchtime and you're going to the cafeteria.
Yeah. And at night, is that locked?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But in the minimum security prisons, your cell stays unlocked all day. So you can hang out by yourself if you want to, but you can also go hang out in, like, the common space or, like, living room kind of area that's on the hallway where your cell is.
Is there a place where you can, like, I don't know, do sports or, I don't know, have an activity to do?
Yeah. At most prisons, there's a place that's called the yard.
Okay.
And so people can go outside, and a lot of people just walk or run in circles and stuff.
Good jogging.
Yeah, and then there's usually a gym, so people can work out if they want.
In prisons, is there any places like in university kind of?
There used to be a lot more. Like a lot of people used to be able to do what's called university by correspondence, mm-hmm. which means they'd be like writing letters to teachers on the outside and sending their homework to teachers on the outside who would be reading their stuff and then giving them grades. Mm-hmm. But sometimes there's this program in the US called Inside Out, Mm-hmm. And it's university teachers who come into the prison yeah. with university students, mm-hmm. and they all take a class together. Okay. So it's like prisoners and university students on the outside mm-hmm. all sitting in a classroom together.
Mm-hmm. And also, I remember that sometimes you can take pictures of, like, of the prisoner and your family or whatever, and in the back, the background is usually... No, I don't... Oh, no, the person that takes a picture is usually a prisoner, right? Mm. Yeah.
What do you know about who ends up in prison? You were sort of talking about this earlier, but, like, are there certain kinds
like
of people?
Why they end up in...
Or like, sort of, like, why,
but... Oh, who? Like, the people?
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of black people, because black people cause racism, and they usually think that the black people are the ones that did the things or whatever. Like, yeah. And they think that they're bad and things like that. And that they're different and they're weird and they're gross or I don't know what. And so this community, well, I don't know if it's still on, but the Black Panther. And there'd be a place where they could get food and things like that. And then, yeah. And also there's, yeah. And, well, black people, like color people. There is white people too, but, like, we're more racist of them than they are us. And if we, and sometimes there's demos and sometimes they're usually like hurt black people. I don't know. Mm-hmm. They hurt black people. But there's even black prison. And there's even black police people. But it's still racist. And then there is also immigrants. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they have problems or something, so they have to go in prisons, like families or whatever, and have to be separated. Mm-hmm. And the immigrants, like, sometimes they don't let them come in because they're from somewhere else, and they have a different color, and they ask you a lot of questions.
Where are the prisons that you go to visit with your dad? Are they, like, out in the suburbs or in the city or in the country?
Well, usually... They're kind of in the middle of nowhere, I find. And I've gone to a lot in USA. But there's usually sometimes it's like there's nothing else around and there's just like a parking place and then a building. And then one time there was a place where it's kind of like a town.
I guess my last question is, do you think we need prisons?
I don't think we need prisons. But maybe I think there's already, like, places where they can get help and, well, be treated well or anything, but, like learn to calm their, like, not, I don't know if they get really mad fast or they don't know to calm themselves and, like, just, And if it's something wrong that they did for real and it's not just something silly, well, then they go there. And if it's just ask. And also, prison, sometimes, I think that they're no use because, well, they waste money for the city and whatever. And then sometimes, I don't know, it can take money off for schools or I don't know what, and it just makes you feel like you're like I don't know, like sometimes also you become crazy if you're always like that because sometimes you're you get to be free and kind of and you just feel stuck and you can like and it's sad because sometimes you die also in mm-hmm. it because you don't get well treated or anything mm-hmm. like that. And if they're still prisoned, I still think it's not good. Well, they can give better food, more activities and more of everything. And better, like, more privacy and, and nicer nicer guards and that they, let's say a forest beside, like, that they can go, like, learn how to do, probably they already know how to do fire or food or anything, so it'll be on fire. Or things like that.
Cool. One of the things that there's a bunch of people in the U.S. who do a lot of thinking about what it would look like for us not to have prisons.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they're really into is all of us trying to figure out how to solve conflicts together.
Yeah.
So, like, if I get in a fight with my friends, or if I am mad at my neighbors for making a lot of noise, instead of calling the cops, I would, like, go talk to them.
Yeah. But, when it's more major, like, kind of, like, killing and whatever, well, that's more, you couldn't say sorry because you killed someone.
Mm-hmm.
But also sometimes people have I don't think it's right that they put some, so if the people have mental problems, I don't think it's right that they put them in there also, because it's their fault, but it's not their fault because they can't control themselves sometimes and things like that. And and also sometimes it's someone else that did the thing and it's not them.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's boring because you're there for nothing. And I'm happy that they let people see them, see their family and their friends. And
is there anything else I forgot to say? Is there anything else you want to add?
I think also there should be at least a limit of time that you can stay there. Not like you can be there for all your whole life, but like a limit. Let's say, let's just say 10 years or something, and not more or something like that. Mm-hmm. And also, when you go to parole, I think that's when you if they say if you can go or not. Well, every time that the people I know go, they never get out, and then sometimes their lawyers are good, and sometimes they're not. And they try to help, usually. And what is exactly parole, though? Like, there's a judge and things like that.
In Canada, there are, like, three to five people, and they're not judges. They're usually ex-police officers.
Okay.
Or, like, they used to be school principals or things like that. Like, they had positions where they had power in their communities.
Mm-hmm.
And they fly around the country and go to different prisons, mm-hmm. and then they sit at a table, and then you come in, and you maybe have a lawyer, or you maybe don't, and you try and explain to them why they should let you out of prison,
mm-hmm.
and then they can say yes or no. Or they could say, yes, we're going to let you out, but you have to come visit us every 3 weeks and tell us everything you've been doing in those 3 weeks.
Okay.
Or, yes, we'll let you out, but you have to live in this house that we run on the outside.
Yeah. I used to live in Park X, and there was, like, a, right beside Loblaws in that place, there was, like, a building for people that weren't in prison anymore, but that stayed in this house. But they were still allowed to go out and people visit them. Yeah, and, I don't think prison is good, because I wouldn't like to be in prison for sure. And also, is there a lot of women prison? Yeah.
Right. More and more.
Okay.
Because
I've never gone to, well, maybe I've gone once to a women's prison that I went to. I just thought that usually people think that it's more men that are going to go in prison than women because they're bad or I don't know.
In Canada, there used to be only one prison for women, and it was in Kingston,
mm-hmm.
and it got closed. And they built a bunch of prisons for women all across the country.
Okay.
And ever since they built all those prisons, they've been filling them up. So there's more and more women in prison now than there were 20 years
ago. Well, it's not, I said that's good, but it's good that there's also, like, not just men, but prisons aren't good. I don't want to say that prisons are good, that it's good that they're women. And, okay, and is there a lot of people that bully each other in prison or no? Usually they're friendly to each other, or...
It depends.
Okay. Yeah, well, prison is this racist kind of... Even if it's for white people. It's for... Well, it's more for black people. It's racist. And then any indigenous people. And what's silly is that... we took... Like, the white people took... The indigenous, like, kind of place and everything, and, like, and it's just silly, I find. Doesn't make sense. Well, it makes sense in a way, but it doesn't make sense because it could do better than that.
That was Franca. She's 10. She lives in Montreal. She sat down with the Prison Radio Show to talk about prison, visiting prisoners, racism, colonialism, and whether or not we need prisons. We're hoping that this piece is the first in a series of talks with kids about prison. So if you know someone who would like to get involved, we encourage you to get in touch with us at prison@ckut.ca.
And covered up my eyes, and the last voice I hear on earth is my mama's cry.
Next is an interview with Andrea Ritchie, an organizer in the U.S. and one of the authors of the book Queer Injustice. Andrea currently coordinates Streetwise and Safe, a leadership development initiative aimed at building knowledge, community, and power among LGBT youth of color with experience of gender, race, and sexuality and poverty-based policing and criminalization in the context of, quote, quality of life initiatives and the policing of sex work and trafficking.
Hi, I'm Laura Flanders. A recent book kicked off with some chilling statistics. The U.S., it argues, is crime-obsessed. The number of people in prisons here skyrocketed. What are we policing in this country exactly? Our next guest argues that looking at the experience of people who are usually ignored in this story, namely gay, lesbian, transgender, and self-described queer Americans, gives some clues, or can, about how we as a society construct our idea of crime and justice and safety. What are police for? Policing deviants? Really? Is that what best serves a creative and vibrant country? And what about justice for LGBTQ people? Andrea Ritchie is a police misconduct attorney and organizer here in New York City. She coordinates Streetwise and Safe, a leadership project for LGBT youth of color. And the book she co-wrote is Queer Injustice, the Criminalization of LGBT People in the United States. Welcome, Andrea. Glad to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
There's a lot of people paying attention to the criminal justice system these days, whether they're protesting stop and frisk or worried about stand your ground laws. Why do you call for attention to LGBTQ people? What's in it for us to learn?
Well, for one, the reality of the fact that among, for instance, the almost 700,000 stops that were conducted in New York City in 2011, the majority of whom were of black and brown men, among those black and brown men are gay men or transgender men or bisexual men or transgender women who are being labeled as men and who are experiencing stop and frisk in many of the same ways as other members of their community, but also in ways that are unique to their experience. And whether it's being called a particular name, whether it's being profiled for a particular offense, whether it's being harassed around what gender your ID reflects, whether it's being sexually assaulted or harassed, those experiences are both similar and different, and it's important if we're going to address the complexity of the problem to have a full understanding of all aspects of it.
So what do some of those different ways reveal?
They reveal that the function of law enforcement in the United States is to police the lines or perimeters, as you would say, around sex and gender and around sex and sexuality as much as they are around race. And in fact, that the policing of sex and gender is an integral function of the policing of race and poverty.
Has that always been true, you think?
Since the moment Columbus first landed, at least as far as I can gather.
Well, you mean that. It's in the book.
Literally. Within a couple of decades of Columbus landing, there's a documented instance of a conquistador literally policing people's gender presentation and sexuality among indigenous people by setting his dogs on them to kill them. And it's definitely sexual violence and policing of gender nonconformity and perceived sexual nonconformity was both used as a tool of colonial domination, but also as a justification for it in this country and on this land, and it continues to this day.
So how do you make sense of it? Why are police, why do they care about our sexuality or our gender expression at all?
Because it's a way of distinguishing between the quote-unquote good and law-abiding citizen and the one who is seen as a sign of disorder. And that's particularly the case in present day in New York City, where we've come back to and are spreading this notion of order maintenance policing. So then it comes down to a question of a police officer looking at you and trying to decide whether you fit into the accepted order of things. And if your gender presents in a way that seems disorderly to them, they can't quite put you in a box, or they feel like the box you're you're presenting is not the one they want you to be in. They're going to read that as a sign of disorder. They might walk up to you and start questioning you, feel like you're suspicious. They might literally write you a ticket for disorderly conduct, for simply appearing in public in a way that they find signals gender disorder or sexual disorder. And this sounds very theoretical, except the young people I work with literally talk about police officers saying, I wouldn't stop you if you didn't dress this way. I wouldn't ask you questions if you didn't dress like a boy. I wouldn't believe you were engaged in prostitution if you weren't dressed like that.
And you document people arrested because they have condoms on.
Absolutely. And obviously it depends where. I think that if a young white man was standing on the corner outside this studio with condoms, people would assume that he was following good public health messaging and doing what he needed to do to protect himself and his community. But a transgender woman of color a few blocks down and over will be assumed not to be following good public health messaging, not to be legitimately protecting herself and her community, but rather to be intending to engage in prostitution.
For people that don't live in New York, describe a little bit of what's going on here. On the one hand, you have, as I see it, some movement on this policy of stop and frisk with the new administration, Bill de Blasio et al. There's been some agreement that that targeting of black men in particular was wrong. There's also, though, a commitment to more community policing, so-called, to more police on the streets. Is that a solution? Is that what these folks were asking for?
I think we're seeing a sort of transformation of how policing is happening in New York City, but ultimately the same folks are being targeted using different tactics. And it's reinforcing this notion of quote-unquote broken windows policing, of order maintenance policing, the notion that small signs of disorder detected by many officers on the street who are perceived by people in those communities as very much occupying forces, addressing those swiftly and surely with punishment of some kind will prevent major offenses. And it's just not been proven. One of the architects of that theory discredited it. Instead just turns into a means of creating a lack of safety for other communities. It also produces the kinds of policing, it creates opportunities for the kinds of policing of gender and sexuality in service of policing of race and poverty that we talk about in the book. It creates more opportunities for police officers to be out on the street looking at people, deciding whether they think that they're a threat, whether they're a sign of disorder, whether they're about to engage in disorder. It gives officers more tools in terms of the kinds of regulations that they're enforcing to then question, harass, target people. For instance, in my neighborhood, I've seen more police checkpoints. So now people are being stopped more in their cars than on foot, perhaps on my block. But the same effect is happening, which is that people are being questioned. They're being asked to produce ID. If the ID doesn't match, if they don't have ID because they're undocumented, then the similar consequences flow. And so... Again, I think New Yorkers need to think carefully about whether these tactics are producing safety or whether they're just another form of policing the same populations in the same ways that are about policing the same systemic power relations.
You talked about ordinance maintenance offenses. Is that an official term? Is that a policing term?
Or there's order maintenance policing. There's something called quality of life offenses. They're ostensibly about maintaining everyone's quality of life in New York City, but really we're not sure whose quality of life they're maintaining.
And that's very different from the laws that we saw passed, we still see passed, having to do with hate crimes. You're against those, right?
I'm certainly against hate crimes, and I'm also against hate crimes laws that are punitive in nature. When we think about other places in the world, the first thing we think about is, are lesbians and gays persecuted? Is their conduct criminalized? And the next thing we think about once that issue is addressed is, are lesbians and gays protected and transgender people protected by hate crime laws? But often the latter is not possible because of the former. Mm. And ultimately, if society is about policing and punishing nonconformity with gender norms and sexual norms, then they're going to do so in the ways that they protect people from violence as well. So police and other folks don't tend to change their behavior when they're responding to people as victims of crime as they do when they believe them to be a sign of disorder generally.
What about anti-trafficking laws that have come in for a lot of attention over the last few years? A lot of people believe we're not doing enough to crack down on sex trafficking, particularly of young girls.
I think that certainly all of us are concerned about anyone being coerced to do anything that they don't want to do, and certainly, or not being paid for their labor. I think that there's a multitude of industries in which trafficking is taking place. I think we focus on one, but we could spend more time focusing on trafficking that takes place in the production of the food that we eat, in the production of childcare in our homes, and in the production of pretty much anything in society. Anywhere there's labor, there's trafficking. The problem with the law enforcement-based responses is similar to that with hate crimes legislation. We've had hate crimes legislation for 30 years in this country, and the number of incidents of violence against LGBT people hasn't gone down. Similarly, law enforcement-based responses come in after the fact, and often, as with hate crimes laws, people are perceived through the same lens by police officers who are responding to violence as police officers who are enforcing lines of race and poverty and gender. And so when responding to prostitution or perceived trafficking situations, police engage in a great deal of profiling and a great deal of violence in their responses and in a great deal of punishment of people who they're ostensibly trying to protect. I've heard police officers say, for instance, that they want to break a victim of trafficking in order to find out who their exploiter is, when in fact, many young people, research has shown, and many people generally who engage in the sex trade are doing so for economic reasons, mm-hmm. And are not being coerced by any one person. And the folks who are being coerced are not in a position where that kind of law enforcement is actually going to address the issue. It's only going to further alienate them from seeking help, and it's going to further push them away from institutions that might be able to help them get out. It's also going to push them away from people in the industry that they're involved in who might be able to help. And so it's really critical that we look at and listen to what people in the industry themselves, including survivors of trafficking, are saying they need. And rarely are they saying they need more police officers, and more often they're saying they need more pathways to immigration status. They need more housing. They need more economic opportunities. They need more of the things that will make them less vulnerable to being coerced into doing something they don't want to do, whether they're trafficked into the sex industry or they're trafficked into the agricultural industry.
Are you getting any clearer about what policing is for? What we as a society are getting out of any of this, other than, I guess, making some money along the way, as you described?
I think policing has been used to maintain existing social and economic structures for a very long time. From, again, we talked earlier about, you know, the first colonial forces arriving and policing the physical bodies of indigenous peoples and just using policing to destroy their culture and their practices and set up hierarchies of gender and sexuality was used as a basis of taking land. And the first modern police forces were slave patrols. And it's clear what the purposes were there. And police have been used to round up immigrants, people engaged in the sex trades, people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender for a very long time. And now are also being used to round up and incarcerate significant numbers of people of color. And so I think in all of those instances, it's about maintaining existing systems of social order. And we need to look at the ways those happen in macro ways and in individual police interactions.
There was an interesting comment by the New York District Attorney, Cyrus Vance Jr., about a report from the Vera Institute that looks at criminal justice issues that revealed racial bias in who gets held in prison and who gets granted bail, who gets arrested or brought in, but then who gets held. And he said, it's not so much whether there is or there isn't unconscious bias, it's what we do to fix the problem. Is there anything we're doing out there that's making the situation better right now, Andrew?
I think right now we're talking about it, which makes it better. I think that the more we can expose and surface the many different ways in which racial profiling manifests in the experiences of women of color or LGBT people of color, for instance, the many different ways that profiling and targeting of poor people and homeless people manifests, then the more we're able to confront it and bring it by bringing it to light, we can then address it. I think that legislative change is important, but it's not the be-all, end-all. It's actually about building movements of people who are working together to make rights realities, who are working together to make rights realities on the corners of the streets of New York, in people's homes, in people's communities, through collective action and education.
Do you see a balance where it works, where communities are safe, not just for a few, but for everybody or for most people, where people feel secure. But at the same time, there's enough fluidity that maybe a little disorder here and there isn't so bad after all.
I think there's pockets of opportunities that come up here and around the world where we can see communities deciding on their own account what safety looks like for everyone and making sure that it's respected for everyone.
Any examples?
I think there's examples in Brazil, for instance, or Argentina, or in many communities where law enforcement is not an option. I think indigenous communities have also found ways to produce safety and healing in their communities without relying on the state, because the state has been a source of violence for them. I think many queer communities have also found ways to stay safe because for a long time the state wasn't even an option in terms of obtaining violence or in addressing violence. I think in many countries of the world, and in the early times of the anti-violence movement in the United States, we look to each other to create safety. We look to our communities, to our neighbors, to our families, to our friends, to our political comrades, to be accountable to each other for our safety and to address problems as a community rather than relying on policing and violence to do so, because ultimately then that will lead to policing and violence along the lines of gender, of sexuality, of race, and of poverty.
So tell us a little bit more about Safe and Streetwise, the project that you're part of, or Streetwise and Safe, and what you're figuring out about how to do this differently.
We approach it at Streetwise and Safe three different ways. One is to make sure that young people are aware of their rights and practice strategies for addressing the realities of police encounters together. And they are the experts in those situations. They survive them every single day, so we share what we know about the law, they share with each other what they know about surviving those encounters, and together they find ways to reduce the harms of interactions with law enforcement. Then they also want to be parts of the conversations about what policing looks like and what safety looks like. And safety for them does not look like a flood of more police officers. That looks like more danger for them. They're very clear about what they need to feel more safe, and they articulate it every single day, and they're demanding it every single day.
And it is?
More housing, more jobs, more living wage jobs, more access to gender-affirming health care, more access to safe spaces, more access to opportunity to express their gender and sexuality in the ways that they want to. Those are the kinds of things that if we just ask folks what they need, they will articulate it. And people are finding ways to keep each other safe in community, because for LGBT youth of color, particularly who are homeless, police are not a source of safety, and so they find ways to work together to keep each other safe. And what's important in those moments is to make sure that we don't also then criminalize those efforts. And so the state sometimes steps in and makes those activities criminalized.
Dean Spade, whom we interviewed on these subjects a little while ago, talked about trickle-up justice. It's a phrase I liked a lot.
Dean has so many phrases. He also talks about distribution of life chances, and one of the things that I've really focused on in the work and what we talk about in the book a fair amount is how much one encounter with a police officer can change the entire course of your life and really change the distribution of life chances that you have. And what we are trying to accomplish at Streetwise and Safe is to make sure that there's the harm of those encounters is minimized, that your entire life doesn't change in that moment. And what we're trying to accomplish through Communities United for police reform and other organizing efforts, sort of whether it's at the local, state, or federal level, is to make sure that's true for as many people as possible.
So as many people as possible can dare to be everything that they are and bring
exactly.
to our society.
Exactly.
Andrea, thank you so much. Andrea Ritchie is one of the authors of Queer Injustice, the Criminalization of LGBT People in the United States, written with Joey Mogul and Kay Whitlock. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Andrea Ritchie speaking about police misconduct against the LGBT community. Ritchie is an author, organizer, and attorney based in New York City. We found the interview on YouTube, and it was produced by Grip TV.
The time is presently 5:48. You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca.
To close out the show today, we'll be talking about a noise demonstration that happened outside several facilities in Laval. The noise demonstration happened on New Year's Eve, and we've already heard a bit of a report back from the Hamilton noise demonstration. So now we'll talk specifically about the one that happened in Montreal. And to talk about the demonstration, give a report back, we have Prison Radio Show's very own Virginia. Hi.
Hi, Noah.
So can you talk a bit specifically about this demonstration and the reason it was organized?
So New Year's Eve noise demos have been happening in cities around the world pretty consistently since 2008 or 2009, I would say. The basic idea behind the demo is that the holidays can be a pretty terrible time to be inside, often pretty lonely. Some prisons don't even have visiting hours on New Year's Eve. And the idea is just to go out and make the walls as irrelevant as we can by making a bunch of noise and wishing a Happy New Year's and showing some solidarity to folks who are locked up for that holiday.
So what specifically happened at the demo? Because I am guessing that each noise demo that's happening on New Year's Eve probably looks pretty different depending on where it's happening. And so, again, we heard a bit about what the Hamilton one was like, but can you describe sort of what the Montreal one was like and maybe what are some of the things that were Montreal specific?
So the last time that there was a New Year's Eve noise demo in Montreal, it actually stayed on the island and went to the two provincial prisons that were on the island. And this year, something we did differently was we went out to Laval and went to the Immigration Detention Center and then LeClaire, which used to be a federal prison but has closed and now reopened as a provincial prison, as well as both the Federal Training Center Minimum and the Federal Training Center Multilevel, which are both federal prisons out in Laval. So one of the things that was different this year was that we went out to Laval. Another thing that we haven't done before is had a noise demo that happened at night out in Laval. There's definitely a history of other noise demos happening or demonstrations in general happening out in Laval at the prisons out there, but we haven't been out there at night before. And so it was definitely interesting to see what the feeling would be like to be out there at night. And especially given the context, like the fireworks are a bit more visible at night, and that was pretty nice.
Cool. So how do you feel it went?
It went pretty well. We had one major glitch at the very beginning where we realized that we had booked the bus for the wrong day. So we had a school bus that was supposed to be meeting people at the Metro Henri Bourassa, and the school bus didn't show up, and we realized that it was because we had booked it for January 1st instead of December 31st. But everyone who had shown up to the demo at that point, which was between maybe 50 and 75 people, we're in really good spirits, and so people were down to just get on the bus and go out to Laval on the bus and pile into the cars that had arrived, and we managed to get everybody out to Laval together despite the fact that we had no bus. And once we were out there, we sort of did a loop. We started at the Immigration Detention Center, walked all the way down Monte Saint-Francois, which is the street in Laval that all the prisons are on, went all the way to the Federal Training Center Minimum, which is a pretty interesting place to stand outside of and yell to. There's just a chain-length fence around the prison. It doesn't even look like a prison from the road in certain respects. And people there opened their windows and were yelling back to us. I believe someone was yelling to us about how great it'll be when Harper is no longer the prime minister. people were wishing us a Happy New Year's from the yard there. We could definitely see and talk to people there, and that was great. And then we turned around and headed back up the road to end at the Federal Training Center Medium, which is a bit weird because we're in a parking lot overlooking that prison and sort of shouting down into the yard. So it's hard to tell if anyone could hear us there, but I thought it went pretty well overall.
Awesome. And what was the police presence like?
There were maybe two or three Laval police cruisers at the Immigration Detention Center when we arrived, and the cops ended up forming a line. There were maybe like 8 or 9 or 10 cops, really not that many, forming a line in front of us at the Immigration Detention Center, following us to our next stop at LeClaire, where someone set off fireworks that ended up shooting off at the police and setting a patch of grass on fire outside of LeClaire. And then they followed us down the road to our third stop at the Federal Training Center Minimum as well, but it wasn't a huge police presence.
Last time we talked about a similar demo, so a demo outside the Immigration Detention Center and other prisons in Laval, there were some concerns that organizers and participants had raised after the demonstration. Can you just mention again what some of those were and also speak about if you feel that this demo addressed any of those concerns?
Sure. We had received feedback from people who wanted us to put more effort into mobilizing in neighborhoods that are affected by prisons in Montreal. So people had mentioned mobilizing more in Hochelaga, mobilizing more in the Point. And so we made an effort to do that. It's always hard to tell how much mobilizing brings people out and what kind of mobilizing brings people out. But I do think that certainly some people were more aware of the demo happening this time. And it was a bit of a different crowd than showed up in September. So we do seem to have managed to outreach to different people than September, although not necessarily more people than that demo.
And looking towards the next noise demo, whether that's next New Year's Eve or a similar kind of demo before that, are there any things that, based on this past one, you would change or that folks have discussed as potential changes or things that have been raised?
I do think it would continue to be exciting to mobilize more and more people who are directly affected by the prison system. I do think we get a good number of people out at these demos who have a political consciousness that prisons are bad or that they want to go show solidarity with prisoners, but we're not necessarily the best at mobilizing folks in very affected communities, except for folks in the Solidarity Cross Borders Network who are very keen to come out to Immigration Detention Center demos because they know people who've done time inside there. But yeah, that's always something to strive for more of, is getting more folks who have either direct experience themselves or like close friends have experience with the prison system to come to some of these noise demos and yell to their friends inside.
Okay, thanks for that report back.
You're welcome.
The time is currently 5:56, and you are listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. To find out what's coming up on the next Prison Radio Show and or other prison and prisoner-related activities in the region, check out our blog at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com and click on the calendar section. If you would like us to post an event you are hosting, email us at prison@ckut.ca. You can also subscribe to our podcast. The next Prison Radio Show will air on Friday, January 23rd at 11 a.m. If you have any questions about anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the show, feel free to contact us at prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. Folks can also leave a message on our listener comment line at 514-448-4041, extension 2547. If you're in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. Feel free to write us at The Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, postal code H3A2B3. Thank you for tuning into The Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Noah.
And my name is Virginia.
And we've been your hosts for today. Please stay tuned.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on.
What?
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? Brought to you live.